Hello and welcome to the Rory Townsend episode of Sigma Sports Presents Matt Stevens Unplugged. What can I tell you about Rory? Well, he's a 28-year-old bike rider. He's a former Irish national road champion, born in Kings-upon-Thames, but his dad is from Waterford. And he now rides for UCI Pro Team Q36.5. And he's loving how well they're looking after him there and the opportunities they're presenting to him. He has a very interesting approach to energy saving within the modern peloton. So keep listening for some top tips from Rory on that. He's a versatile rider who can't really be pigeonholed into a specific category, and we chat all about how you need to be versatile on a smaller team. He's a poor man's Mads Pedersen, his words, not mine. So, with that in mind, maybe sit on an inexpensive chair, perhaps a plastic one, get comfy, relax, and perhaps enjoy some supermarket own brand snacks, which we all know are sometimes better than their big brand counterparts, because this is the Rory Townsend episode. Podcast. Rory Townsend is a powerful rider with a moderately big frame that gives him the strength needed to excel in one-day races as well as sprinting, but he's also pretty handy on the hills. Riding for UCI Pro Team Q36.5, he needs to be versatile, not just in his ability, but in his schedule too. We recorded our chat in late March, at a time when Rory didn't know whether he or his teammate, Simon Sanyok, would be riding Tour of Flanders. Spoiler alert, it was actually Simon. But now you can listen to this podcast knowing more than Rory about Rory's own life. Check it out.
Well, Rory Townsend, we finally, after a few technical issues, our recording. Welcome, Matt. Welcome, mate, to Matt Stevens Unplugged.
Good to see you. Good to see you, mate.
Where in the world are you right now? I mean, I think I roughly know where you are because there's obviously a lot of racing going on, but can you just describe to us where in the world you are? And actually, describe the room around you and who you can or maybe can't see.
So I am in... I actually have to check if I'm actually in Belgium or I'm in Holland because I'm in Limburg.
Right.
I am actually in... Oh, I'm in Holland right now.
So, there you go.
Yeah, we just crossed over the border. We're in Holland, ready for the Ronde van Limburg tomorrow, on Saturday. Just in the hotel here now with my teammate Simon. So, yeah.
Hello, Simon. Is he just there?
No.
Can you hear? No, he can't hear. You've got headphones on. Yeah. No, good stuff, mate. I know you've been on the road and we've been trying to fix this up for a little while. And funnily enough, we'll talk about some of the racing you've done already in a little bit. But I'm actually commentating on the Ronde van Limburg on Saturday, mate, before I go over to Flanders. Have you ridden that one before?
I have, yeah. I've done it for... twice, maybe three times before, actually. Yeah, three times. I've had two editions with snow and rain all day last year. So currently, it looks like it's going to be better than that. So
That's good. Because, again, people think, oh, Holland, apart from races like Amstel Gold, it's pretty flat. But Ronde van Limburg, I mean, it was absolutely split to pieces last year. It was just like, it was like a sportif, wasn't it? It was just everywhere, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is, they call it like the mini Amstel and stuff. And this region, honestly, I absolutely love it. It's such a lovely part of Europe. Honestly, it's really nice. The roads are great. Terrain is nice. So.
And, you've got some pretty decent form at the moment, haven't you, mate? Let's be honest. I mean, you know, you were top 10 in Camembert, ninth there in Paris Camembert, and then backing up your win in Rue Tarangelle, which is, I was commentating on that as well as last year's one, with a fourth place after winning it last year. I mean, that was, disappointed maybe with fourth, considering you won it last year, but all things considered, that's not a bad way to come back to the same race, is it?
No, I think it was a funny one. It was a really like bittersweet kind of finish in the end because, like you said, last year was incredible, and obviously really special having you on comms as well, Matt. And but yeah, I think the race itself this year was it was mad. So there was a massive pile up. sort of midway round. We had a long stop after that, which was good in one sense. It meant that I got back to the race. So, because I came down sort of in the middle of it. And then I think going from that situation, at that point, he said to me, like, oh, will you take fourth today, all day long? But then in the finale, you know, and it's like once you're in the mix and stuff like that, to come fourth, it's a little bit of a shame. And, you know, I look at stuff and think, like, yeah, maybe could have done better there and here. But yeah, I think all in all, it was encouraging. And definitely, I hope Limburg is hopefully another opportunity before some massive races coming up the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. So what actually does your program look like? Because you are down on pro cycling stats as doing Flanders because the team are doing it, aren't they? But you're not going to do Limburg and then head over to Flanders, are you? Or are you? Are you?
It remains to be seen. So we've had an absolute, yeah.
Oh my God.
breaking news for you guys. We've had some pretty awful luck in the team, and just the number of injuries are just racking up. We lost Nicolo Parisini recently, broken collarbone. So currently there's six guys down, and myself and Simon, like, it's he or I basically are going to be flown in last minute. And obviously I've thrown my name in the hat. You don't need to pump up the race. Like, it would be an amazing experience to ride it. I think it would be cool in the sense I could do Limburg, like try to go for a result and then go to Flanders and just experience it, be part of it with kind of a bit of a, I don't know, free kind of rain to do the best as I can, you know, and try help the boys, try get involved in the break at the start and see what happens.
So to when, because I was looking at that because you said you didn't know whether you're doing Flanders or not. And I know that the very name, and we'll talk about the team in a minute, and it's something that I don't think is discussed enough, but, you know, quite often, especially in teams with maybe not quite as much depth, or even with teams, I mean, the team's got like 25 odd riders though. It's a big team. There's a lot of, I was looking through the list. I mean, let me just have a quick look into it. I mean, you might know off the top of your head, but there are 27 riders. So it's only a couple of riders off world tour size. There's a lot of depth there. But as you say, all you need is a few injuries, some illness, and then clearly riders that aren't suited to that sort of race. And you've got to start doubling up.
Yeah. I think, obviously, so we're a second division team, so we don't have as many riders as the World Tour teams anyway. And recently we've had guys, so at this race we have a guy from our Conti team as well stepping up. And I think those guys have had more opportunities than they might have done. And also, like, for our team, we have some clear, like, sort of grand sort of tour specialists, you know, like just pure thoroughbred climbers and things, and then the guys sort of a bit heavier set like me and some of the guys that are doing the classics and stuff. So I guess it's not like, I think a lot of pro Conti teams, they're very much focused on one thing. You know, if you look at like Tietema, they got a lot of guys built for Holland, Belgium, stuff like that. Even the same with like Tudor and these kind of teams, they're very sort of sprint focused. Whereas we have a really good climbing squad with guys like Brambier, Damien Housen, Mark Donovan. Like, they're great at what they do. And then we have some really strong guys on the classic side, who unfortunately are missing, with Frédéric Frison and Giacomo and Nizzolo as well. So that's just with those two guys, that's a massive loss for us. So we are having to sort of adapt on the fly. And I mean, it's been great for me being thrown into these races, and it's such a steep learning curve though. Like, and it's crazy. Like, this is the first real classics season I've done as such. And it's crazy in a way that you think, like, for some guys, like, this is their season, you know. I've always had to be like, I couldn't be so like picky. I always wanted to be like in a good shape throughout the year to always perform whenever an opportunity arose.
So this must provide you though with some potentially unexpected opportunities, because, I mean, maybe the next question should be then, what did you expect when you joined Q36.5? First and foremost, massive opportunity to race at the next level. But in terms of your role and your job within the team, what was that going to be? Well, what was the conversation when you joined the team about your position in the team and what was expected of you?
Yeah, I mean, when I joined, they'd made some big signings for this year and similar kind of riders to me, I suppose. And I think I was coming in as almost like a secondary option to a few of these guys. And I saw it that, you know, say on this weekend, for example, I'd always planned to go to Limburg and try, that would be a race for me where I could try and get a result whilst, you know, the guys went and tried to do what they could at Flanders. So it's been good in the sense that I've been able to experience some of these bigger races. I rode the opening weekend and did this kind of stuff. And then I've been in France and things and still going after my own results and things. I think I'm sure a lot of the listeners will know, like, there's this whole kind of battle and stuff, points. And that was kind of part of the reason that I came on board. You know, I think the idea was that generally you could put me in a few different races and I'm always likely to pick up a few points here and there and try and supplement the our like big performers as such. But certainly, like, over the course of my time here, I hope to be one of those big performers. So
I mean, just looking back through your results, especially over the last couple of years, and obviously you with Black Spoke, you had a really good year with those guys, and I've no doubt it's your consistency, as you said. You know, if you're not in the top 10, you're just outside the top 10. You're regularly scoring points from the beginning of the year to the end of the year, you know, and winning big as well and beating some big riders. I mean, how do you class yourself? What is it, 28 now? How do you, you know, what sort of rider do you think you are? What sort of rider do you think you can become? Because you've got some opportunities for yourselves and for yourself, but I guess you're still coming to terms or trying to understand the type of rider that you are, given the opportunities that you're allowed.
Yeah. I guess if I was to try and sum it up in a succinct way, I'm like a poor man's Mads Pedersen, I guess. right. Or maybe even that's a bit of a compliment, you know. But I think I came in, I was like a bigger build, you know, and yeah. As you know yourself, like, so much of the UK scene is about crit racing and doing that kind of stuff. So that was my introduction to cycling, like doing that kind of stuff. And I think I would have kind of focused in on that a little bit more, but, you know, I had the opportunities with Canyon in my previous teams where we'd come over to Europe and, you know, these races are really hard and you can't afford to be like a pure specialist in any kind of way. So I kind of had to diversify a little bit, and being a smaller team as well, it means you don't always have the same level of support. So, like, often, you know, I'm fighting at the end of hard races and I'm either there by myself or just maybe like couple other guys at best. And so, yeah, I don't know. I had to be a little bit more rounded, I think. And I suppose part of like growing up in the UK as well is part of that as well. It's not like, you know, we have the terrain kind of develops you as a rider as much as you might have your own ideas about what you are, you know, your surroundings and stuff kind of dictate where you're going to go.
Yeah. And I mean, it's worth actually at that point going back to the squads that you're with. I mean, essentially, you were riding with Tim Elverson's team, weren't you? You know, Canyon and all the iterations back to like 2016, and until you actually moved on. And you were there when the sport in the UK, or like elite racing in the UK, wasn't in a bad place, and there were teams vying for selection for the Tour of Britain. And then it's kind of just, let's be honest with you, over a period of a couple of years, there was this precipitous implosion almost, wasn't there, which is something that maybe is the subject for another podcast. But during that time, at what point, I mean, you're riding at Conti level, I mean, Tim was great, I mean, from the outside looking in at the program that he gave you guys on a very, very limited budget, I mean, it's clearly served you well, isn't it? I mean, because, I mean, look at what you're doing now. You've not, a lot of riders at 26, 27, if they haven't quite made it, they're kind of gone. But the fact that you persevered and are now riding it in your late 20s, at the highest level you've ever ridden at, it's got to be testament to the grounding that you had with Tim's teams over the years in the UK.
Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, I mean, there's so many points that I look back on and think it could have gone a different way. And of course, like now looking at it, I'm so glad I just stuck at it and stuck with it. But no, for sure, it was really difficult at times and being on that team. But we had such a great group of guys as well, and it was like I often think like those kind of days with Tim and that team were the days that I'll look back on when all is said and done. You know, like just hours and hours in the van with the guys, like feeling like you're going on tour, such that kind of thing. And it's like it was just really good. And I think potentially the sort of the best thing that I had, or the thing that served me the best, is that I had no expectations of what I was going to do in cycling. It never seemed like a realistic option for me. Like I raced as a junior, but I was pretty hopeless, to be honest. I really wasn't great. I went to uni and did all that kind of stuff because it was just like I just followed the path, you know, of like this is just the simplest route. So I just went to uni. I carried on racing with Tim because he, you know, gave me a bike and gave me no reason not to race, you know. And it was almost like I had no barriers really to stop me from doing it, so I just kept plugging away. And I think for some guys, like especially guys who are blessed with just this natural talent, you know, they're sold a dream and they imagine how their life is, how cycling is going to be for them and how things are going to progress. And then when it doesn't live up to their expectations, it's very difficult to deal with that. Whereas I guess I see it as a benefit that I never really had these expectations. And I just kind of just kept going. Like my foundation kind of motivation in the sport was just purely to see, like, let's see where it goes. Like how good can I be, you know? And part of that is riding for a team like Q36.5, because they put everything in place for us to be successful. You know, I'm unbelievably well looked after. Like it's crazy. And I'm so glad that I've got this experience now to see like how things operate at the top level of the sport.
Yeah. That's really interesting you say that about just racing your bike and enjoying it. And that point about spending time in the van with the lads, I think that takes us back again to when you first start riding as a junior, just getting, and it's the social aspect of the sport, which all these conversations on all the various pods and interviews I've done, cycling often comes back to that. So how much fun you have actually off the bike actually is massively important for how motivated you can be on it. When you're with a group of people with, you know, different characters, different aspirations, different aims, different abilities, but just having fun on the road. And because you do spend probably more time on the road than sat in the saddle. You're in the seat of a car more time than you're on the seat of a bike most of the time, aren't you? You're traveling around. And so that journey through the several years you were with Canyon and with Tim's team. So what else did you get up to in life? Did you have any other qualifications? Or, I mean, because this perseverance must have come from somewhere year on year on year. Was it just because you thought it was fun, or that there was always success and you thought, well, let's see if I can push it? The fact that you didn't seem to put any pressure on yourself. What actually, was there another part of your life that meant that you were pretty settled in being satisfied with just seeing how it's gone? Because it's quite an unusual way to do things.
Yeah, I think, I guess it kind of went in stages. So I was like, I enrolled in uni at the usual kind of age and stuff. And I did a couple of years there. And then at one point I thought, okay, right, let's give this a crack and see what I'm capable of, kind of thing. And it was, in 2018, that was what I was thinking I was going to do. So it was like 2017, I had a really good year. I won the national series in the UK, did quite well in Europe and stuff, and sort of like just missed the opportunity to move to a different team and stuff. So I thought, right, 1 year, like full gas on the pedals, like do whatever I need to do to, you know, make it happen. And then 2018 was just horrendous from start to finish. I crashed in the very first race, broke my wrist, came back from that, broke my collarbone, blah, blah, blah. Like 2018 was just a write-off. And then after that, I was like, okay, you haven't had a fair shot at it. Like, let's go again. Like, do what you need to do. One more year, 2019, all in. Let's have at it, kind of thing. And then again, like I've sort of bounced back and really probably had the best year that I've had on the bike in 2019. And again, the plan was to move up to the pro ranks after that, and then things kind of fell through, unfortunately, and that made it really difficult, like going into COVID and stuff like that, because I had nothing, especially for a Conti rider. Like there was nothing for us really to do. So yeah, that definitely was a really tough period. And then so I kind of had to readjust and look at it again. So at that point, that's when I went back to uni after that, finished off, and I was doing like some coaching and these kind of bits on the side, like, you know, taking knowledge from my degree and my experience as a rider as well, and helping to coach a few guys. And that was kind of helping to supplement my, allowing me to eat and and do that. So, it's been like a really strange, journey, I guess, not the normal one, but I wouldn't have had it any other way. I think I take so much strength in from the bad times now, and I really just appreciate every day that I have doing what I'm doing now and not having to panic about the old problems I used to have, like thinking about this month's going to be tight and things like that. Like I can now comfortably live and I'm just so grateful for that, and I can just fully focus on cycling. And I guess a big factor for me is I often think about what I might be doing in 10 years time or wherever it is, like if I'm sat in an office, if I'm just doing a job, whatever it might be, I'm terrified of the idea that I'm sat in that office thinking like, what more could I have done? So as much as I'm motivated to find out what I can do, I'm almost on the other side. It's like, I feel like I'm scared not to reach my limits as such, because I just don't want to be like someone thinking like, oh, what else could I have done? That's a real like thing for me. I don't know where that comes from, but yeah.
Yeah, it's something that you owe yourself, especially given all the ups and downs you've had. And like you said, I think what you've been through over the years, especially the grind that is that has been the domestic scene. As I said, the domestic scene has had its highs and lows. You've seen a little bit of that. It wouldn't have been a surprise to have seen you've just jacked things in and gone elsewhere, but that's testament to some sort of inner strength, mate, isn't it? And how would you describe yourself? I've asked you to describe yourself as a rider. What about a machine in terms of, do you think you're pretty physiologically blessed, or do you think you've got an okay engine, but you're working really hard at it? And I say that because you say you're like a cup prize Mads Pedersen or something, but we can't all be the top level riders. But there's also riders who obviously train really hard, but are blessed with the DNA of an extraordinary endurance athlete. And there's others who are pretty solid, but just work very, very hard. I know that one of my mates, a lad that you all know, Dan Lloyd, admits that he had a pretty kind of small engine, but was super, super smart in races and in training, and worked very, very hard to get the most out of himself. So how would you describe yourself, especially now, especially like plunging in to like opening weekend at 28 years of age and thinking, oh my God, this, I mean, you've clearly had to work very, very hard to get where you are.
Yeah, it's a funny one, right? Because, you know, I said that as a young rider, like I wasn't really at the level and things like that. Like I wasn't very competitive and stuff, which is true. But I think obviously so much of that comes back to, you know, people just develop at a different age. I've kind of always thought to myself of like, I'm someone who lacks that natural talent, and I've just been like a grafter and I've just got after it and stuff. But I don't know, like it's funny because then I speak to people who I've like ridden with for years. Like one of my best friends, Noah, like he says to me, like he remembers like he trained really hard one year and then came to Hillingdon and I was racing having come back from sickness. I think I beat him in that and he was just like, oh, like, it doesn't matter what I do. Like he's always going to be better than me. So I hear stuff like that, which is then quite contrary to like this idea I have about myself where I'm just like, I lack that the gift. And so I suppose it must be somewhere in the middle, you know? And
right.
I think I've definitely found from like 2019 onwards and stuff, like I've seen more of a development in myself coming from the, like really thinking about the races and like, and actively like reflecting on each race and trying to learn from it, much the way I suppose Dan did. And he probably cottoned onto that idea quicker than I did. Whereas I was, you know, I used to just turn out to every race and just like smash around as hard as I could and hope for the best kind of thing. And you definitely can't get away with that at opening weekend. So I've wised up a little bit in that way and have been, you know, quite fortunate to be on teams actually where guys have had that mentality, like Matt Bostock, that people will know from the domestic scene. Like he's unbelievable. Like the way he like thinks about a race is so smart. Like he's really switched on. And also Ryan Christensen, an old teammate of mine, like we used to go into races, right? And for the first couple of hours, like we would have a competition to see who could average the least amount of power.
that's brilliant. I've never heard anybody say that. That just makes so much sense though, doesn't it?
Honestly, like it is crazy. Like when you start doing this and you're really, really considering it, right? And you're thinking about like, you know, breaking late into the corner and then letting a few guys come past you out of the corner so you're not having to accelerate so hard. Like it's amazing. And then of course, like you have that sort of positive reinforcement that you get to the end of the race and you're like, oh, my legs feel amazing. And it was like a real like light bulb moment for me. It was like, God, what have I been doing all my career? Just absolutely like...
It is funny though, isn't it? That's what I love because our sport is so complicated. There's so many layers to it that even if you had like a 25-year career, you know, you're going to be learning to the very last day you turn a pedal in anger, aren't you? But quite often, although there's some really, really smart young riders now, there's... The older you get, just by virtue of having spent more time in the saddle, seen more race scenarios, become more critical of yourself, you just learn. And that actually gains a lot of momentum. The actual craft of bike racing, as well as the physical side, but the craft of the nuanced side of understanding bike racing, I think is fascinating. And as a commentator now, my racing days are long behind me, mate, but watching a bike race now, I find it thrilling, you know? Looking at riders who have got real racecraft, looking at riders who are just holding back a little bit, riders who are having to think more because they aren't as blessed as your Van der Poels or your Van Aerts, but are wily enough to still win big bike races. And that craft is something you're clearly pretty good at, you know, because I've watched it and I've commentated a few of your races now. And there's also the skill, there's craft, like understanding a race, knowing how to save energy, but then there's also moving through a bunch, mate, and I've seen you do that, and that's something that you're very good at. Yeah, I mean, has that come more from? Is that something you feel comfortable doing? Is it something you kind of work on, or is it something that's quite innate? Because you can move around a bunch, from what I've seen, pretty well, especially in a complicated final.
Yeah, it's honestly, I don't think it's something that I'm naturally blessed at. Sometimes. When we go to some of these races sometimes, I see the way some guys handle their bikes, it just blows my mind. And I'm not gonna sit here pretend I'm the most skillful guy in the world, but I think I know now at this age more than I did 5 years ago, like the points at which investing energy is rewarded, you know, like when is it worthwhile to like press on the pedals and actually make those efforts rather than like pressing on the pedals and then 3 seconds later having to tap the brakes, you know, because that's just complete waste. So that's something I've definitely come across. And then I think when it comes into the finale, like I often look back at stuff and think like, God, that was quite good or this and that. And honestly, like it's really interesting. I explain it to, I don't know, like non-cycling people, I guess, like there's this thing in my brain that everyone has it. It's like, I need to touch the brakes now, or like, I should slow down here, or, you know, that sort of like primal sort of like survival mechanism that you have in your brain.
Yeah.
And I honestly, sometimes we get to like 20K to go or whatever it is, or even just like a important part of the race and stuff, and that little thing in my brain just switches right off. And all of a sudden, like, you're not thinking about like a bit of water in the corner. You're not thinking about this. You're looking at the guy in front of you and thinking, how am I going to get through him? I think the point at which I lose that ability to switch that off, I think it might be quite tough to be a bike rider at that stage.
Oh, mate, I couldn't. Do you know what? I've never heard anybody describe it quite like that. But you are quite right. And I think as I got older, the more that I was consciously thinking about the risks and what I was doing. You know, I remember in the couple of years before I stopped racing, and this is obviously years after I was riding at the top level, but still at a pretty decent level. And I just remember, you know, this thing you were just talking about, switching on and off. I was like, moments I was just floating up the bunch in the gutter, taking risks, getting in just to hold my place in the crosswind. And then suddenly it was as if that ability was starting to fade. And then I'd suddenly be really aware of the risks I'd just taken, like, shit. Mm. And then I'd drop back, and then that would go again. But when I was younger, and it was the same on descents as well, it'd just be like, I'd just follow the wheel, and it would just be completely and utterly in the zone. And you need that, mate. As soon as you start overthinking and, you know,
yep.
You're not innate, and you're basically, I mean, it's fine to overthink, but it's going to be problematic, isn't it? It's because, you know, not thinking about racing sounds kind of strange, but when you're fully dialed, you're not actually thinking, you're just doing, aren't you? And without even it's quite an amazing place to be in, isn't it? When you really sit back and then think about it.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's just, you in these moments, you just need to be, it's subconscious control, and you just need to allow like your experience and stuff to take over and things. And it's definitely something I've found recently on this team, like stepping up to a higher level and feeling the responsibility of trying to perform and stuff. I sometimes put a lot of pressure on myself to in these races, and I found myself like second guessing and messing up a finish from there. And it was, yeah, I think it was just a reminder to me, like, just don't overthink it. Just like play it out. And when I look back to, say, that Tour Angel race last year that you worked on, and like, I wasn't thinking about anything. I just, like, the guy in front of me finished his effort, and then I started sprinting. Like, if it was I think I started sprinting at 2:50 to go, or something like that, which if I was thinking about it, I'd be like, oh, this is way too early.
Yeah.
But I just thought at the time, it was just like, right, time to go. And that was that, you know?
Yeah. No, there is a lot of discussion about overthinking things, and yeah, it there are so many moments in a bike race, including when you're following attacks or deciding not to follow attacks. There's this instinct that kicks in that's massively important. That some riders, I think we all have it. Everyone that races at top level has it, but to varying degrees. And there's some riders that have just got this amazing knack to just go. You need an engine to back it up, of course, but it's a topic I could talk about a lot. But one thing I do want to talk about, we've touched on it a little bit, is just describe the feeling of stepping into, you know, the opening weekend. From you've raced at a very high level before, otherwise you wouldn't be racing at Pro Conti level, mate, or Pro Team level. But what was that like for you? Were you full of apprehension? Just describe the feeling of going into opening weekend, because that's, you know, in itself would be the dream of a lot of riders, mate, who never ever make it, you know. So just describe what that was like for you.
Yeah, it was, honestly, it was just a bit of a blur. Like, it's a shame in that way that it's like, it almost kind of passed me by a bit, because I was just like, yeah. And I think I went into it, like, I didn't go into it with the greatest form either. I'd had a few like little injuries and little niggles and stuff like that, which is a shame, because I really sort of took away from the experience. I went into it thinking about myself and thinking like, oh God, like I hope my knee's okay today, which was the problem at the time, you know. And so that's why I think when I look forward to the races that I've got coming up, I'm just gonna like fully embrace the experience. I've done enough races now bed into the team, and I know where my seat is on the bus and stuff, so I don't have to think about all of those other distractions, you know, that come about for the first weekend. But I mean, certainly the atmosphere and everything that makes these races so special, really got hold of me. You know, I was given the opportunity to try getting the break at Kerner and absolutely blew a gasket trying to do so. So I got swallowed up in that sense. So.
And what have you had to change much in terms of your training? I mean, there's obviously with Blackspoke, the team that unfortunately folded, you had a pretty decent race program. That's where you got your success as riding as Irish champion. But what have you tweaked, or have there been any big changes in the way that you've been training, or have you stayed with a particular formula? Has that changed much in the last few years, given the landscape of racing at the top level, which I seem to be just talking about all the time, because it is such a feature of the way that races unfold, the condition that riders can get themselves into. We are looking at, I wouldn't say a different sport now, but a very different looking sport. And how have you changed during this kind of period over the last 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, I suppose there's been a couple of shifts, I guess. So I in the early days when I was running at Canyon and stuff, I was fueled by this constant idea that I wasn't good enough and I didn't have the ability and stuff. And I just always had this thing of I'm just going to out-train everyone around me, you know?
Okay.
And I really lent into that. And I think at the time it served me quite well. It definitely brought me on a lot as a rider. And then in 2019, I had, before that season, I had to have a lot of time off after a shoulder operation and things. So it was it was the least amount of training I'd done in the winter, going into that year. And yet I just went into the season just absolutely flying, straight from the gun. And it was just one of those years where it didn't feel like everything I did just seemed to click, you know, which was part of it. But it was kind of planted that idea that okay, maybe I don't need to be smashing out 30-hour weeks with a load of efforts and all of this sort of stuff. And you add into the fact that with Wout and Mathieu coming through, the cyclocross generation is, if you you know, you look at what they do in winter, really high intensity and then really easy base mileage and stuff like that. And I've kind of taken a bit out of that, and that's a lot of what I did in preparation for the first year in Blackspoke.
Okay.
Which served me really well. I did a lot of base training, and then I went to Blackspoke as a sprinter myself and Matt Bostock. That was our role. So I really had to okay, I need to lean into that and really work at that, because I know my numbers are not competitive right now in the sprint world, you know. So I just did some really focused sprint work, and it really paid dividends, coming into the year a bit fresher. And all through last year, I didn't really train, to be honest. I just went from race to race, and just I've really found that less at this point, maybe it's just this point in my career, I've been riding for a long time now, and I kind of feel like less is more, and I have more issues when I overdo it than when I just kind of poodle around. And it's funny that it's kind of gone like that. I've had to try and change my mentality about training, because I am someone that wants to get out and do the extras and stuff, because that makes me feel a little bit more, takes away some of those anxieties of the idea that I'm not good enough to be here. You know, if I know I've been out and trained the house down, then I can say to myself, well, look at what I did in training. But definitely taking my foot off the gas has served me quite well, I think, more recently.
That is really interesting, Rory. You know, and I think I certainly found something similar in my career as well. Less is more. I used to train like an absolute demon when I was young, and because I thought that was the right thing to do. And it was actually taking, although I was never coached, it was like, I remember Chris Baldwin back in the day saying, what's the point of doing all these loads of miles? Because in a bike race, you've got to go faster. Mm. And it's very, no, it's not quite as simple as that, but you soon find And I was eating loads. I was eating a lot. And I think I cut down my eating by about a third because I was just panicking, like doing long distances, got to eat loads. It's actually, you still need to eat enough, but don't need to eat as much. But that all took time because, and this was before the advent of the amount of information and the metrics that we've got, and that everything is so measurable isn't it? Which is on one hand great, but also you can be easily overloaded with it. But that is fascinating. I mean, are you coached from within the team now, Rory, or is it externally? Or I mean, how does that work from a coaching perspective? What's the team's stance on the coaching side of things?
Yeah, so we're all coached within the team. So we have, I think, 6 coaches on the squad. Which is, a bit of a change for me because I was much like yourself, Matt. Like, I was self-coached for a long time, and it was kind of I always really enjoyed that. And it was, I kind of had this like a bit of a, not panic, but I was a bit like, oh, the idea of like, of handing over all of this responsibility to someone that I didn't really know was something that I found a little bit difficult at first. But my coach, Helmer, is, he's a great guy, and he really listens to my input about things. And now it's almost gone the other way, and I'm very much like, no, I want to follow like what you have to offer. You know, like he worked at Bora for 7 years, I think, so he's seen it all, done it all. You know, and I'm now like a lot more interested to get his feedback and perspective on things, and. Yeah, no, it's going well. So I have a really good relationship with him.
That's cool. That's cool. Well, I tell you, we're going to take we're going to change pace, Rory. If you don't mind, it's been great so far, but we are going to change pace and we're going to change subject matter. You might remember that a few weeks ago I asked you your place of birth and where you were brought up, purely because it's time in the podcast now for the Chertsey quiz.
Yo, what's up? You're ready?
Okay.
Let's do it.
Turn off your phone.
That's right.
Get your thinking cap on.
Yeah.
It's time.
What time?
Time for the
Chertsey quiz.
Well, it's time for the Chertsey quiz. Now, I know what we won't go into was the fact, Chertsey, is that where you're actually born? Or were you born in Kingston?
I was born in Kingston, yeah.
But you're brought up in Chertsey, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, mate. Well, I've got a quiz. I don't know how many times you've listened to Matt Stevens Unplugged. It's been a theme for the last 50 or so episodes when we ask our guests a little fun quiz on their hometown. Okay. Now, don't stress too much. I know you've got a big race coming up on Saturday and potentially an even bigger one on Sunday. So what I don't want to do is dig into your psychological reserves too much. It is a multiple choice quiz, you'll be pleased to know. So
let's go.
Are you ready, mate? Okay, right. Here we go. So the name Chertsey in its modern spelling dates from way back in 1559. With the first part Chert, that's thought to be the name of an individual of Celtic origin. But my question to you, what does the C in Chertsey mean in Old English? So Chertsey, I want you to tell me, what does the word S-E-Y mean in Old English? Multiple choice. Does C mean A, island of the east? Does it mean B, of rural meadow? Does it mean C, island or well-watered land, or does it mean D, of godliness? So Chert is somebody's name. So Chertsey, so it's somebody's name, island of the east, of rural meadow, island or well-watered land, or of godliness. What does Chertsey mean?
See, I would think it was the meadow, because we have that, I don't know, there's some meadows around. I'm wondering if it's the water because it's on the Thames. So I think I'll go with C.
Correcto mundo. Good start, Rory. You're in the early break of the day, mate. Good stuff. We've had some, we had on the other week? Poor old, who was it? It was Rod Ellingworth. Zero. No points. There you go. So it's a good start. You're in the early move. question.
Excellent.
No, I didn't mean to be horrible to Roddy. It was a great pod, actually, but his quiz skills were limited. But the questions are quite hard. Anyway, so next up.
He is good at other things. So.
He is very, very good at other things. He's actually remarkably successful at other things. So doesn't really need to know about Grantham too much, does he? Righty-ho. So question number two. Thorpe Park on the northern border of Chertsey has over 30 rides, Rory. Okay, that's a lot of rides.
Okay.
Has over 30 rides to choose from, which means there's a whole lot of thrilling family fun awaiting you, according to the website. Of these four, which is not a ride? So I'm going to read you four rides out, one of which I've completely made up. Okay, so I'm just going to move my... apparently, I'm getting a bit loud, so I'm just going to manoeuvre. Do you know why I've got a bit loud? It's because my writing is atrocious and my eyesight's failing. What an awful combination. So I'm going to stand back from the microphone a bit. So, Thorpe Park on the northernmost border of Chertsey has 30 rides. Which of these four is not a ride? A, The Walking Dead, The Ride. B, Samurai. C, Flying Fish. Or D, Wham! The Ride. Which of those four is not a ride at Thorpe Park?
The first one sounds awful.
It does, doesn't it?
I don't know what that is, but that's not something that I want to be... I will not be signing up for that.
The Walking Dead...
I'm going to go B.
You're going to go B. So you think The Walking Dead is a ride, but you're not going to go for it. You think Flying Fish is a ride, and Wham! The ride, you think. So you think B, Samurai. Unfortunately,
it could be Wham. I think it could be Wham as well. Oh God!
Rory, I'm going to have to take your first answer. The answer, the fake answer, which I invented because I'm a big fan of Wham and George Michael and his mate Andrew, who's a keen cyclist, I believe. Wham the Ride is not a ride at Thorpe Park, but you never know. I'm very sorry about that, mate, but had to take your first answer. But The Walking Dead, The Ride is basically. It's a zombie apocalypse sort of ride. Yeah, pretty grim. Right, you still got...
Yeah, I figured they would, because they do all of those scary mazes. They do all those scary mazes and stuff, so I figured that would be.
Have you been to Thorpe Park, Rory, being a resident of Chertsey?
Yeah, it's one of those things that it's just... When it's on your doorstep, you sort of take it for granted. So I don't think I've been there... I don't know. It must have been... 15 years since I've been there, and even when I did, I didn't go there. I wasn't a regular.
Okay.
I went for one Fright Night and never ever again.
Fright Night, was that like a Halloween themed evening or something?
Yeah, it was awful. It was really awful.
It does sound like we might be in PSD territory, so we'll leave that. We'll leave that one, mate. Right, so you've got 50% of the questions right. This is now question number three. Okay. Question three. Which world-famous rock drummer lived in Chertsey on St Anne's Hill from 1971 to 1975? So, super famous rock and roll drummer lived in Chertsey on St Anne's Hill from 1971 to 1975. Was it A, Ringo Starr, B, Phil Collins? Are you looking this up? C, Keith Moon, or D, John Bonham. So, Ringo Starr.
It wouldn't be Phil Collins. So, Ringo Starr, I think he lived in Henley.
I think you're right.
Let's go Keith Moon.
You're going to go for Keith Moon.
Who's the other one?
I'd stick with your answer if I were you, mate.
Yeah, who?
Keith Moon. Yeah, you've got it. You're correct. Well done.
See, I've got to, as we've already learned, I've got to stop overthinking stuff. Just go Keith Moon.
Keith Moon all the way. Once laid himself down in a bath full of beans. He was an absolute bonkers man. Unfortunately died very young, but an absolutely prodigiously talented drummer for The Who, of course. The other answer was John Bonham from Led Zeppelin. So it was indeed Keith Moon.
Yeah, I didn't know. I didn't know who that was, so I just,
well, you went, yeah. You basically did what, like, as you said, you just, you know, you just reverted, you went on instinct and you got the right answer. So you're in a good position. You've got two questions out of three right. And if we can get question four right, we're staring 75% in the face, which isn't too bad at all. Right, question four, the final question in the Chertsey quiz, Rory. What is the name of Chertsey Town? What is the nickname of Chertsey Town Football Club, who were founded in 1890 and now play in the South Central Division Isthmian League? Whatever that is, blimey, Isthmian League. So, what's the nickname of Chertsey Town FC? Is it A, the Fishermen, B, the Curfews, C, the Bridges, D, the Islanders? So the Fishermen, the Curfews, the Bridges, or the Islanders? Nickname of Chertsey Town FC. Final question.
God, I got no idea. I was an Abbey Rangers man. That's where I grew up playing football. And I know there's a big rivalry there now, but poor. I'll go shot in the dark. I'll go with the Curfewers.
It's correct, mate. You're shot in the dark. An answer, purely on instinct. It is the Curfews. Well done, mate. Good, good guess.
I love that.
So basically, I invented the other three. The Curfews originates from King John. So King John, way back, we're talking about the 1200s, was, depending on your point of view, was either a brilliant king from a business perspective or a very cruel one. But one of his cruel traits, and it did it nationwide, was to set a curfew so folk couldn't go out at night. And the church in Chertsey still rings at curfew time, although obviously it isn't a thing anymore. But yeah, the curfews are basically based on the curfew.
That is very interesting.
Imposed by King John. Look him up. He was a bit of a twat, I think it's fair to say. Yes. So let's just toss up the scores there. I don't think he's got any living relatives. He probably has. And I wonder if any of them listen to the pod. But anyway, please get in touch if you're a relative of King John. So 75%, let's hear it for Rory. A round of applause from our assembled studio audience. So that is a really good example of... going with it. You didn't think, you just went straight in with that one, didn't you, mate?
Yeah. Oh, that really reaffirms that idea of what we talked about earlier. So, yeah.
Exactly. And I think without a shadow of a doubt, whenever you do anything good in life, whether it's making a really good cup of tea or just getting your hair right, I'm not too sure, it does give you morale. So hopefully I've given you, Rory, a gift to take into the races over the weekend, just to boost him around. Not that you need it anymore, just to give you an extra little bit of a boost, just to race on instinct. You just never know. Right.
No, that'll definitely help.
Yeah. I've just got one or two more things to ask you, mate. And what's your ambition, mate? I mean, you've got a 2-year deal with Q36.5. What would you like to achieve over the next couple of seasons, mate? I know we've kind of touched on the sort of rider you are, the freedom you're given in the team, but coming into the squad and the opportunity aside, what would actually you like to achieve personally, mate?
Yeah, so I guess there's a few layers to my answer in that. And it kind of comes back to that thing I said before of just like, I just want to see how good I can be in cycling and see what I can achieve. And, you know, having that idea of like, just kind of leaving it all out there and getting all of what I can out of the sport, which, you know, it might sound like a bit of a boring answer and things like that, but really like the days when I'm on the bike and I feel really, really good, I really feel like I can do anything. And I just want to have that sensation as often as I can. And cause it's a really special feeling. And then I think more specifically, like I set myself a target of 3 wins this year. So that's I guess something a bit more tangible, I guess. And one of them always, like every season I come into nationals is always something that I look at. That's always a massive date in my diary, to go back to Ireland and try and get the title again.
Fantastic. I mean, actually, just while you mentioned the Irish Championships, I mean, taking that big win last year in the jersey, just describe what that feeling was like, because actually it was really interesting when we were chatting and arranging for you to come on the pod, and we're asking about where you're going to be, and you said I'm doing the route Tarangelle, a big race in France, and you're on the front of the race program, aren't you? And in that winning the race in the Irish national champs jersey, just describe what that win meant to you.
No, it was. I mean, it was so special just in having that win, for one, like a big European win. That's kind of one element of it. And it also just felt like the perfect thing because, Ireland's a small nation, but in that sense, you feel really connected to everyone. And so part of it is like you want to represent the jersey on the European level and have people seeing you do it, kind of thing. So it kind of felt like a big moment in that kind of way. And particularly that race, for whatever reason, just felt like really special. It was where Ireland were based in during the World Cup for the rugby. And I went back to France the week after the race, and I got like the newspaper article from like after the race, you know, reporting on it. And it was, the title was like Ireland's first win in Tourangelle. Like referring to the rugby that they were coming over and staying there, which is a really cool like thing to have as well. And yeah, you know, you mentioned about the race manual as well. I managed to steal a big poster of it as well when I was at the race last week. So that's a cool bit of memorabilia I have to go home with.
Oh, that's brilliant stuff, mate. Well, Rory, it's been an absolute pleasure. I think what we'll have to do, I'll probably have to give you a call after the weekend, or let me know I'll see how you get on in Limburg, because I'm going to be calling it with a colleague of mine down at Eurosport. But also, if you do end up riding the Ronda on Sunday, you'll definitely have to send us a voice note, and we can tag that on to the end of this podcast, mate. But either way, it's always been a pleasure. Best of luck for the rest of the year, mate. And yeah, just keep on doing what you're doing, because you're clearly loving it. And what I do like about your journey is the fact that you've found yourself in this, but you've worked really hard to get there, and there's no way that you clearly want to relinquish it. You want to milk it for what it's worth, and that's fantastic, mate. So, Rory, it's been a pleasure.
Cheers, Matt.
Best of luck, mate, and thanks again.
Cheers, Matt. Thanks a lot. Great to chat to you.
What a great chat. Thanks very much to Rory, and all the best for the rest of the season. And I can tell you that while he didn't feature at the Ron van Vlaanderen, he did ride Paris-Roubaix and finished. Chapeau. And funnily enough, I once actually spoke to Mads Pedersen, who said he was a wealthy man's Rory Townsend. So there you have it. This podcast was produced by Niall Gaffney on behalf of Hot Chili. Thanks to Perry Ap Gwyneth for the podcast theme tune, and thanks to you for listening. Don't forget to like, subscribe and rate the pod, and why not recommend it to anybody who's looking to save energy on the bike, although Rory's approach might not work on a solo ride, or when you're late for work, unfortunately. Cheers all, stay safe, and goodbye. That's right, isn't it? Because you'll just be even later for work.